Hello and welcome to another edition of the NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk podcast. I'm Kurt Heelan, the managing editor of Pro Basketball Talk, and today we have with us one of the best beat writers out there, A. Sherrod Blakely, covers the Celtics for CSN. You read him online, you see him on TV. Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem. Glad to be here.
They're an interesting team this year. I think they're performing a little better than I had expected. I think I was a little more down on them than a lot of teams. But at 14-11 right now, I mean, they've got to be relatively happy. This is a solid season. They look like they're a playoff team.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people anticipated when you looked at their team and you looked at their schedule to start the season, for them to be hovering around 500 really is a positive for this team. You know, they played some really good teams both on the road and at home. And right now, you know, the Celtics, they're feeling pretty good about themselves because for the most part, they have been able to compete with any and every opponent that they've faced. And that I think, has breeded a certain level of confidence that if they can continue to play well and just really give themselves a chance to be successful, they're going to win more games than not. And that has been the case so far this season, and certainly they hope to continue along that path going forward.
Well, I think a perfect example, though, of where they're at as a team was a couple days ago when the high-profile Tuesday night game against Cleveland. First off, their defense kept them in that. That shows you how good a defensive team this can be. They did the same thing a couple nights before that against the Warriors. This team can defend with anybody.
Well, they can, and that has to be their calling card because they figured out real quick that their best shot at winning is defending at a high level because they don't have, you know, the kind of shooters that you see in Golden State and some other teams where they can trot out, you know, a starting five with at least three or four high-impact scores and another two or three coming off the bench. The Celtics are not built that way. They are built as a team that can defend at a high level, and make timely shots, and more than anything else, position themselves to be successful. And that really has to be, you know, at the heart of what they do night in and night out. They're not going to win every game, but they have to, at the very least, give themselves a shot at success. And the best way to do that is being able to defend at a high level.
I think one of the keys to their success, both defensively and a little bit, frankly, offensively, unless they're going up against an elite team, is that they are so deep with good guys. This is a team 10-12 deep in rock-solid, average to above-average NBA players. They go to their bench, and it doesn't hurt them. They can switch around to match up with you, and they can do it in a variety of ways and not hurt themselves. There's not guys they're hiding.
Right, and that's what makes them really one of the more unique challenges for a lot of teams to face because, you know, when you look at most teams in the NBA, you've got your starting five, and then you've got, you know, a couple of guys coming off the bench who can also make an impact. But the Celtics, really, from 1 through 10, there's very little let-off when you take one or two guys out and replace them with guys off the bench. And that affords them an opportunity to play at a relatively high level throughout the majority of the game. Now, that, you know, that's the positive side of tit-tat, but the downside is you don't have that alpha male, that go-to guy that can carry you on those nights when you really do need that one guy to just assert control of a game. They still are searching for that guy, but obviously you look at their team, you know, Isaiah Thomas has certainly at times been that type of player, but I thought in the Golden State game and also again in the Cleveland game, I thought that really his lack of height, which is something most nights and most games he can compensate for, I thought it really hurt him and the Celtics late in the game because when you're that small and you're only 5'9", it's a lot harder to get separation in the closing moments when teams are really looking to just come at you with more, you know, fierceness and ferocity than they would earlier. So the Celtics, you know, they're a good team, but they're still in search of that go-to guy that they can lean on when, you know, down the stretch in close games.
Yeah, how much do the fans there love, though? Everywhere Isaiah Thomas has been, the fans eat him up. He is a fan favorite, I imagine, there as well.
Well, he is, because I think for a lot of fans, he's literally just like them.
Yes,
I mean, when
exactly.
You see Isaiah, he can easily blend into the crowd, you know, and into the streets of Boston and with very little fanfare because he's not your prototypical NBA player, 6'2", 6'3", or 6'9", walking around town. So I think that is part of the appeal to him. But the other thing about Isaiah is is he genuinely wants to connect with fans.
Yeah.
He's one of the more demonstrative Celtics in terms of, you know, if they're making a couple big shots, and he's the guy that's trying to get the crowd engaged and doing those type of things. And if he's on the bench getting a breather, he's the guy that if the second unit is on the floor doing some positive things, he's trying to engage the crowd then as well. So he's certainly a fan favorite, but, you know, again, I'm still not sold on him as the go-to guy for this team down the stretch, just because, again, the height, I think, is a major disadvantage down the stretch.
And you saw that against the Cavaliers. All game long, they've got guys like Shumpert, who's now injured, but they've got guys like Shumpert, even J.R. Smith, who are pretty tall and pretty long, and then you guys got to see the first iteration we've seen this season of actually like healthy, fast-moving Mozgov, or relatively fast-moving Mozgov. And if that guy gets in front of you, I don't care who you are, unless you're like Kevin Durant, just shooting over that guy is not easy.
Yeah, and he's one of the more, I think, underrated two-way players, because his strength allows him to really give you a certain, you know, it helps you solidify, I think, that back line defensively. And on offense, you know, when he gets that ball in the middle of the paint, you're done. He's too strong to move from that spot, and he's got too nice a touch to miss very often when he catches it deep like that. So he's one of those guys that gives Cleveland a mismatch that, as you get deep into the postseason and things like that, they're going to look to from time to time. And he's proven, I think he's a guy that can deliver for them.
Yeah, not to go off on a Cavaliers topic for 10 minutes, but I think that you hit on a key point about them, which is they're going to be able to throw different, if when healthy, they're able to throw a lot of different looks at you. You guys got to see for long stretches that Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson front line, where it's a smaller front line but aggressive on the board still. They can play a little defense and get a little rim protection but have better offense. And then they can switch that up and go big with Mozgov depending on what's going to give you the most trouble.
Yeah. And that's, you know, for the Celtics, you know, that's one of the things that they would like to pride themselves on, is having versatility along that front line. But the thing that they're still missing, they really don't have that physical banger at the center position. But Amir Johnson, I give him a lot of credit. He's really stepped his game up defensively the last couple of weeks. He's starting to look like the player that the Celtics were hoping they would get when they signed him in the offseason. And David Lee coming off the bench is starting to kind of find his rhythm, his groove as well. So there's a lot of positives that are happening with that front court. The biggest challenge that they seem to have these days is figuring out who to play and who not to play. Because, again, with all that balance and parity within this roster, because there's such little separation, it's very difficult, I think, for Brad Stevens to figure out necessarily what are the absolute best combinations. He's had a lot of good ones, but figuring out the best ones, that's the challenge.
Yeah, and actually that was something I wanted to get in with you, which is that there is such a, I mean, this is an incredible front line of depth. I mean, there's just really elite, good players. I wouldn't say elite, but good players, solid players, all along the front line. I mean, what is the combos that he's going with? I mean, when I'm watching, I like the Amir Johnson-Kelly Olynyk matchup. I know he's still starting Sullinger, but is he leaning towards certain rotations now, certain lineups a little more?
It's all about the matchups. I mean, the coaches talk always about how, you know, I'll play the guys that give us the best matchup opportunities. And for the Celtics, it literally changes from one game to the next. I mean, there are games where Kelly Olynyk at that 4-5 position is best suited to play big minutes, and maybe Sullinger isn't. Other nights, Sullinger's a guy that does, I think, a good job at that position. Some nights, Avery Bradley is going to have a mismatch, and the Celtics will look to exploit that. Other nights, it's Isaiah Thomas. There's a lot of good talent, but not great talent on his roster, and that's why they're going to be a team that's going to be in the playoff hunt throughout, you know, the season. But they're still lacking that one X factor, that go-to guy, that alpha leader on the floor, go-to guy in the final minute that the elite teams have. They're a good team, but they're until they get a guy that has that DNA, they're not going to be any better than just a pretty good team.
And obviously that's one of the targets. Is that something it's easy to say that's something they should trade for, but is that, and Danny Ainge certainly has lined up more than his fair share of assets. Is that how he plans to go after that kind of alpha player, or how can he acquire that guy?
Well, they've got assets that include draft picks, young up-and-coming talent, guys who've been in the league 3-4 years who are starting to show signs of being really good players. And the goal is to find a way to get that type of player, whether it's through the draft or trade. I think their best shot is through trade, just because when you're trading for a player, you have a much more realistic body of work to examine as far as, will this guy fit in with our culture? Can he get it done from a number standpoint? Is he ready to be that leader? Has he been a leader elsewhere? You have a lot of those same questions and then some when you're talking about a first-round pick or a lottery pick. I think their preference would be to use some of those assets and get a difference maker. But, you know, worst-case scenario, they're going to be, you know, drafting guys, you know, fairly high in the draft for the next couple of years.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you need a little bit of luck. Anybody, including Danny Ainge, who said that they were going to take Kevin Durant over Greg Oden is blowing smoke. But you get lucky and Kevin Durant falls to you at number two, or, you know, somebody slips to number three or four who ends up being the best pick in that draft. You get a little bit lucky, you know, and nailing that draft is, it's an art form. So some GMs are really good at it and some not so much.
Yeah. And that's really what, you know, the Celtics, you know, are very mindful of. They know that the draft is a crapshoot. But when you're talking about trading for players, there's a little bit more certainty when you're going that route. When you traded for Kevin Garnett, you knew what you were getting.
Yeah.
When you acquire a Ray Allen and you pass on a Jeff Green first time around, you know exactly what you're getting. And when you're not totally sure what you gave away, but you know what you're getting is really good and is going to help you immediately. And that's, I think, for the Celtics, I think they're inching closer towards that point where they're nearing that point where growth is not going to be enough. You want to start positioning yourself to be one of the last teams standing. I don't believe it's going to happen this year, but I do believe they can take a step in that direction by finishing with one of the top four or five records in the Eastern Conference, which isn't that big a stretch when you're considering how clustered things are in the Eastern Conference, aside from the Cavaliers, who I think will once again be the top team in the East.
Yeah, actually, I was going to get to that later, but I'll ask you now because you kind of came around to that topic. I mean, that's the funny thing about the East is that I could make a case for about six teams, and frankly, Boston probably in that mix, as ending up the number two seed and the best team. I mean, Chicago's in there, Toronto's in there, Charlotte is surprising everybody and playing in that. I mean, there's so many teams you could say are the second best. Who do you see as the team likely to kind of break out of that pack and, like, make it to the Eastern Conference Finals?
You know what? I watch the Celtics closer than anybody, so you know, my perspective is a little skewed along those lines. But looking beyond Boston, you know, I just think Atlanta is going to find a way to just get it together and just gradually creep their way back up near the top. They've got all the core guys back from a team that was wildly successful, with the exception of Carroll, who's in Toronto. But they've got the majority of the guys that they won with last season, and I just think that they're going to slowly but surely position themselves to be a factor. And Indiana is another team that I keep an eye on. I mean, Paul George is back, and that's a huge, huge plus for them in their efforts to get better and to become, you know, a relevant team in the Eastern Conference again. And those two guys, plus the Celtics, I think those are the three teams that I see fighting it out for one of those top two, three spots in the East, behind Cleveland.
Yeah, and I'm with you on, Paul George is probably my favorite, one of my two or three favorite stories, if not my favorite story so far this season. He has just been, that he came back with a better jumper, and, I mean, when he was being carried off at the end of last year, I didn't think he'd come back this kind of fearlessly. Like, I thought that we'd see the tentative guy again, and we just haven't. He has been so much fun to watch.
Yeah, and I mean, he's playing the way that you were hoping he would play. I mean, he's a phenomenal talent, and you want to see the best players playing their best when they step on the floor. And he's certainly doing that, and he's doing it with a level of consistency. The time off, I think, really allowed him to just get a better feel for how can he impact the game in ways that maybe we hadn't seen before. I like some of the things he's doing now in the post, which is something that hasn't necessarily been a strong suit of his game, and I don't think it was because he didn't have the ability. I just don't think it was something that he was asked to do because of who they had in the middle. But things are different now. They're looking to be a little bit more running gun. They're not going to be Golden State, but they're certainly looking to attack more in transition now than we've seen in the past. And I think that really plays well into what he can do as a player.
Well, you know, if you want that guy back in the middle, the Lakers would gladly give you Hibbert back.
That's one of those, you know, no refunds on Allen Street, Indiana. You are more than happy to just let that one, that ship sail.
Yeah, exactly. I think most of the Laker roster feels that way right about now. You're also, it sounds like you're with me a little bit on the, I just don't believe in the Bulls.
No, and I want to, but my issue with them is that when your franchise player is, frankly, as unreliable as Derrick Rose is, and again, it's not taking a shot at Derrick per se, but it's the reality.
Yeah.
His health is a concern every single time he steps out on the floor. And the more I watch him play, I don't see him playing with that reckless abandon that made him a league MVP at such a young age. I see him looking very tentative. He shoots more floaters. He doesn't seek out contact the way he used to. And it takes away from what he can do as a player. And if that is your go-to guy, your core guy, him and Jimmy Butler, your core isn't going to be as strong as it should be. And that's why, you know, I'm down on them a little bit. And the whole Noah coming off the bench thing.
Yeah.
He's a guy that sets the tone for what you want to do defensively. Having him come off of the bench, I think it is a veiled shot at the defense, and that we're going to be a more offensive-minded team now. And I just don't think that team is built to be that way. They've got a lot of really, really good defenders, and they've got a few scorers. They're trying to figure out how to balance both of those dynamics to be successful. But I just, when I think of Chicago basketball, winning Chicago basketball, defense is a big part of it, and I just don't think right now that is as much an emphasis for them as it should be.
Yeah, I think that's a front line where you could match up a little bit, like we were talking about the Celtics doing, where I would actually like to see them start for a while, just see how this works. Noah and Mirotić, when he's, you know, when they're healthy, let those two go, and then bring Gasol to score off the bench, and maybe play him more minutes off the bench, but give, you know, let him pick your spots a little bit with them, because I'm with you. I think right now their offense isn't that great, so I would rather go with the defense first mindset with some guys who can stretch the floor. And then, by the way, you're going to have
they've got some guys that I think you're right can certainly help them. And the thing about Gasol is that he's going to be effective whether he's starting or coming off the bench.
Yeah.
And there are very few guys, I think, in the league that have the ability to impact the game the way he can, and can do so whether they're in the first unit or second unit, whether they're playing 35 minutes or 25 minutes. I think he's still going to be a relatively effective player. And, you know, with such an egoless game, I mean, he would more than be willing to take that off the bench role if it made them a better team, which I think it would.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'll tell you what, there isn't, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, and you've probably dealt with this going around the league too. Hard to press to find a nicer guy and a better interview around the league than.
Oh, he's the best. He is the absolute best. Is giving of his time to the media, is giving of his resources to various charities.
Yeah.
I mean, he really is one of the genuine good guys in the NBA. And, you know, when the Players Association is trotting out different guys for doing different things, he needs to be front and center more often than not, because he really is one of those guys that you just like having him around. And you talk to his teammates, they feel the same way about him. You talk to other coaches, he's a coach's dream.
Yeah.
He's one of the good ones, and the Bulls are very, very fortunate to have him.
Yeah, I will say I was talking with the person who runs one of his former teams, the guy who's the liaison for charity programs and getting the players out to stuff, and we were talking about the challenges of getting some guys out and who was good and who wasn't good in the community. He goes, you know, though, you just get spoiled when you have Powell. It's like,
yeah.
You know, so going back to the Celtics and a little bit on the trade topics we were at, they have a very, very valuable, although they keep winning now, the Brooklyn Nets unprotected first round pick. Would they be willing to move that, or would it have to be a really special deal? What would be the situation there?
Well, I think it would have to be a player that they feel tremendous confidence and faith in, who can come in and really move the needle, so to speak, get them to a place where they're no longer in this crowded pack of teams. They're a cut above the majority of the Eastern Conference. It may not get you to being on Cleveland's level, but it can get you to maybe that next level and some separation between you and the rest of the Eastern Conference. And you know, the player that certainly we're going to talk about really up until the trade deadline is DeMarcus Cousins of Sacramento. A phenomenal talent, can do a lot of things offensively, but, you know, just in my conversations with league executives and talking with other coaches throughout the league, you know, the concern with him is not so much him going off the rails, because you know going in that's going to happen. It's what's going to happen after he does that. Can you reel him back in to where he can be more of a help than a hindrance to your team's success? And that's why a team like Boston is just not a good fit. They don't have the type of established veteran leadership on this roster that can keep a guy like DeMarcus Cousins in check. You look around the Eastern Conference, the one team that I think makes the most sense for a trading partner, if they can produce something that the Kings want, is the Miami Heat. Because whether you add DeMarcus Cousins to that team or not, their culture is not going to change. Yeah. It's still going to be Dwayne Wade's team. It's still going to be Chris Bosh's team. Those two guys have the kind of credibility that if DeMarcus goes off the rails, they can reel him back in and get him back in check. Very few teams have that type of you know, caliber talent that's proven, can still play, and has, frankly, a need for a player with DeMarcus' skill set.
I know that's a really popular trade idea, but I've been bandied about now for more than a year, probably, back there. You probably get more messages on Twitter and emails about that than anything. I will warn Celtics fans listening to this, as somebody based out on the West Coast, I know of no actual plans to move him. That the problem there is twofold. The owner, well, if you're thinking about moving him, A, they're actually not bad when he plays. They're like 9-8 when he plays. But more than that, the owner, Vivek Ranadive, loves Cousins, like is probably the biggest supporter of him in the organization. And B, remember, they open a new building next year. Like, they move into a new building that they got to sell. And if you get rid of your most popular and face of the franchise player, you better have something coming in the door that's just as good. And I'm not sure anybody's going to be able to offer that. So I don't see a move happening unless Cousins and his camp really push it.
Yeah, and that's the only way it's going to happen. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense for Sacramento moving, because no one is going to give them anything even remotely close to fair market value. Teams will be willing to give them picks, absolutely. But as far as actual players who can come in, make an impact, and have, you know, enough sizzle about them where you can move into a new building and people will be okay with that trade, I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I think that kind of trade in a year or two is more likely. I don't think it happens before they're in the new building and before they've sold some of those seats. But if things are still not there in a year or two, it is more possible. And although, you know, again, part of the challenge here, and I think part of the reason he's getting a lot of calls, is what Vivek Ranadive and the Kings are going to do minute to minute seems to change. So there's not a lot of solid consistency out of that organization over the last while, and things are certainly they make things interesting for those of us writing about the NBA at times. You're actually somebody who dealt with Rondo and was around him a lot. Was what happened with him a surprise to you?
No, absolutely not. It wasn't surprising, just because Rondo is a different type of player when he's on the court. He's very competitive, and when he feels that you are not giving him a fair shake, he is going to let it be known that he doesn't think he's getting a fair shake. And in the heat of battle, you're going to say things that if you were thinking level-headed, you wouldn't say, but that doesn't diminish the fact that you said them, and it shouldn't take away from that you meant what you said. And what he said was hurtful. There's absolutely no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And I think, frankly, I thought the league took it very lightly on him. Yeah. I'm looking at that situation, and if it wasn't Bill Kennedy, if it were, say, a female official and he made some type of derogatory comment towards her, would it only be a one-game official? If it were, you know, a white official and he made a racist comment to a player and they had it on sound, would it just be, a one-game penalty? I don't think that the league came down as hard as they should have on him with this. I think they treated it as if it was just a kind of brushed under the rug type incident. He was wrong, and we're just going to do the absolute minimal to address it. So that was a little bit disappointing to me. And as far as Rondo's apology and then the second apology, I didn't really find either one of them all that believable. And the fact that he issued a statement rather than actually, you know, I don't know, getting in front of a microphone and being so that you can actually have some video and you can get a better sense of whether he was apologetic about it or not. I thought that was a bit of a cop out on his part. But look, he's been suspended one game, and it doesn't look like the Kings will do anything internally to punish him for that, and they're going to try to move on from this. But I do believe that this is going to become another mark against Rondo when teams are looking at him and comparing, should we sign him to this deal or should we go after this player? This will be one of those things that certainly is going to be in the let's let Rondo slide and go somewhere else category.
And this is
bad because he's having a great...
Yeah, he's playing really well.
So much like the Rondo pre-torn ACL. But this is certainly the type of thing that really gives, I think, a lot of GMs a moment to pause as to whether or not we want to add this guy to our team next season.
Yeah, and that's a rough time for him to do it, like you said, for him personally, just because he has spent a lot of effort and put a lot of energy into rehabbing his image. And I will agree, I would say, having had conversations with him just kind of casually off the record, like you have, I'm sure, many times, he's really smart. He can be thoughtful and kind of funny, a little abrasive at times. He's kind of a challenging personality, but not in a offensive way, usually. At least it wasn't with me, but I think you're right. I think this was a line that's crossed, and, you know, like you said, am I going to give him $10 million to bring him into my team, or am I going to look at other options when I'm spending that money? This is going to play into that decision.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly helped himself with his play, but this incident, it really is a black eye on his reputation, and it'll be interesting to see how teams view this going forward, because it will definitely, when teams are weighing the pros and cons of signing Rondo, this is going to be something that's going to be in the conversation, absolutely.
Yeah. So you said, and you went out on a big limb and said that the Celtics probably don't want to bring in somebody like Roy Hibbert. Are they going to be, when they're looking for guys to trade for, are they just looking for that kind of A-list alpha guy, or are they looking positionally right now? What kind of things are they looking for?
Well, I think what they're looking for is a guy that can come in and be a high-impact player, a guy that can be a difference maker in a multitude of ways. Because that's what they need. I mean, they don't necessarily need a point guard. They don't necessarily need another guy who can shoot, although it would help, but you don't necessarily need that. You don't need any more bigs. You got too many as it is. You need guys who can play at an extremely high level. And those guys, as we both know, Kurt, they're hard to find.
Yeah.
But for the Celtics, you've got assets. You need to find a way to flip some of those and bring in a player like that. Do not be surprised if they look to bring, like, I wouldn't be surprised if they made a run at a guy, you know, like a Ryan Anderson, for example, mm-hmm. and use a couple of their assets, maybe a pick and a player like Kelly Olynyk to bring in, and him, who was a guy that he's one of the best scorers in the NBA this season off the bench. He's a flat-out stretch big in every sense of the word, and he has the ability to score in a post in certain matchups. So I could definitely see them making a run at a guy like that, particularly if New Orleans, you know, continues to struggle the way they have.
Yeah, that's a roster, I think, where you're going to see them make some moves just because, look, you talk about needing, look, it's hard to get the alpha piece. They got the alpha piece. They got the next great thing.
Right.
But those pieces that are around him right now don't work. And Ryan Anderson does work with him, but that's not the long-term answer. And if they can get pieces that they think are better long-term fits with that, I think that they'd be open to it. So I think he's definitely, I love, by the way, they did one of my favorite things today. You hear out of, we're not shopping him. Of course, if you call, we'll listen and talk, but we're not shopping, as if that somehow this was different. I love that semantics.
Yeah. That's really what happens in what I call the silly season, which begins basically, it began on December 15th when you can start trading guys that you signed last year, or last summer rather. You're going to hear lots of different rumors about this, that, and the other, but at the end of the day, everyone is available. No one is untradeable. There's no such thing as an untradeable player. Even guys with no trade clauses in their contract, as Kevin Garnett proved, you can still be traded.
Yeah, well, how about, you know, Carmelo Anthony has a no trade. You guys could just go after that. I don't see any problems there.
Oh, as a Syracuse guy, I love Carmelo, but I like Carmelo from about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Carmelo today, not that crazy about this one.
Yeah, that's it. He's a guy who becomes hard to move because he's got the no trade, so he can control where he wants to go, and he wants to be a star. He wants to win in a market, but how many places can you put him that he can do that right now? So, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, again, that's another place where maybe Miami, but I don't know that they need another slow older guy who doesn't defend well and has some creaky body parts. So, I'm not sure that that's the I'm not sure that that's going to be the best fit for him. It's going to be interesting to watch because I just, you know, was talking about this with today in a PBT Extra. It's like he and Kristaps Porzingis make an interesting combo, but their arcs are so different that I don't know. The Knicks have to think long-term with Kristaps. I don't know what you do with Carmelo.
Yeah, he's a tough one to figure out right now just because his game is on the downslide. But listen, he's still a guy that you have to worry about whenever you're game planning against the Knicks. And that's the thing where he's at now. He is, as long as he's healthy and he can step on the floor, he's a threat to go off for 30. And you have to respect that. And that, I think, is why you know he has great value to the Knicks because he really does force teams to respect what he can do. And that should, in theory, open things up for some of his teammates.
Yeah, he is definitely still there. He still definitely has value on the court. So, ultimately now, we're talking about Boston. What would you say is their goal for this season? I mean, what do they see as obviously, I think that growth and improvement was part of it, but I think we're seeing that. I mean, by the way, one thing we did not get to. What a steal with Brad Stevens. What a find by Danny Ainge. This guy is one of the best young coaches in the game and a guy who could be around for a long, long time doing great things.
Yeah, there was a reason why they were so secretive about just the recruitment of him because they knew if word got out that they were after him, he would have stayed at Butler. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So being able to get him to the league has been a huge plus for the Celtics. When you talk about the Celtics and you ask players about them, you know, one of the first things they talk about time and time again is how well coached they are. LeBron James talked about that before the Cleveland game. You know, Detroit's Stan Van Gundy talked about that before they played the Pistons. You know, and Reggie Jackson also plays for the Pistons. That was the first thing he talked about before they played Boston. So you go down the line, and it's that same narrative wherever they go, and that speaks to the respect that they have for Brad, which is surprising because of how young he is, and the fact that he doesn't have the NBA pedigree where he played in the league or coached in the league. They're judging him simply by what he's doing in his current position, and that is more often than not giving the Celtics a chance to be successful.
Yeah, and you remember what Jared Dudley said last summer when one of the great interviews around the NBA, but Dudley was on ESPN or a podcast or something, and they were talking about it. He's like, hey, everybody wants to go play for Brad Stevens now. That's a guy, you know, it's going to still be a challenge to get stars, but guys will go play for him in that market. That's an attractive opportunity now.
Yeah, and Danny Ainge certainly hopes so. it hasn't quite worked out that way. I mean, basically the biggest name free agent that they've been able to get so far is Amir Johnson, who's a good player, but Amir Johnson doesn't exactly move the needle in terms of fan interest and things of that nature. But clearly the Celtics with Brad Stevens are trending in the right direction.
So what's their ultimate hope? What are they hoping for out of this season? What would be a good ending for them? What do they see as a goal?
A good season would be getting out of the first round of the playoffs. Last season they got swept by the Cavaliers. This season, obviously, they'd like to build on that and do better. And while simply getting a win in the playoffs would be, you know, tangible improvement, I think their mindset is getting to at least the second round of the playoffs, that's the kind of success that speaks to their plan of how to build this team working. Making that next step in the process. You know, the first year they took a lot of lumps, and they followed that up with, you know, a better season. And Brad, the next step for them is getting to the playoffs and getting out of the first round.
So you can actually build by bringing in good players and doing this rather than just trying to get into the lottery every year? Because I heard that you had to in the East just tank every year. I guess I heard that wrong. Well,
yeah, there's a team in Philly who seems to be enjoying that tanking thing quite a bit. But the funny thing about this season has been that the Eastern Conference, for the most part, has actually fared better than the West.
Oh, much.
For most of this season, the Eastern Conference had a winning record against the Western Conference. So I think the pendulum is slowly but surely swinging eastward. The best team in the land is Golden State. And last I checked, they do not constitute a portion of the Eastern Conference.
No. Actually, I would say the two best are still in the West because the Spurs are nipping their heels. But I think the middle of the pack in the East is better. When you get into Boston, and but also into Toronto and into Chicago and into the teams, you know, we can pick apart and say they might not be contenders, but those teams are a little bit above 500 and pretty good. Meanwhile, out west, I mean, Houston's a mess. Memphis suddenly looks very old. Like, teams we thought would be better than they are aren't. And, you know, when we're picking apart holes in the Clippers and Thunder.
Right, yeah, I mean, there's definitely an improvement across the board in the Eastern Conference, and in the Celtics, they're part of that wave.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it comes down to what can you get done in the postseason, and that's where I think it's really going to be interesting to see how the East plays out. Because other than Cleveland, I don't think there's another team in the Eastern Conference that is confident right now that they're going to get out of the first round. And if you're the Celtics, that's a great situation to be in, because you know, you're going to go into the playoffs, hopefully, looking to build off of what you did last season. But more importantly, you go in with the confidence that you're not really going into it as a significant underdog unless you wind up having to face Cleveland. Every other matchup is one that you could see yourself realistically winning, whether you have home court advantage or not.
Yeah, and I think that that's what's going to make the Eastern Conference playoffs fascinating, is that, like you said, as it stands right now, barring what moves and injuries happen over time here, Anybody outside of Cleveland could get bounced in the first round or make it all the way to the conference finals, and you wouldn't be stunned. You wouldn't be like, no. Oh, I can't believe Atlanta did that, or I can't believe Toronto did that. They're all capable.
Yeah, they really are. And that's one of the beautiful things about, you know, the Eastern Conference, that it's really, this is about as wide open as we've seen it in a while.
Yep, right. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us and talking some Celtics, and enjoy your holidays. Happy holidays to you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right, fans, we will be back next week with more Pro Basketball Talk podcast Monday and Thursday. And be sure to check out Thursday, where we preview all the Christmas Day games. Talk to you next week.